Yeah, what I want to talk about today is about the idea of the Messiah. And then we'll see how specific we can get. And if I could at some point connect it even with the title of the class, that probably would be very good. So the first thing that we have to appreciate is that Judaism is a religion that is a messianic religion, very, very simply. From the very beginning of time, Judaism believes in a concept of redemption. Now, I want to explain something which at times is not understood properly, and in order to speak at all intelligently about the concept of Mashiach, we need to understand. First of all, and this may get some people upset, so all the better. As far as Judaism is concerned, when you read the Chumash, read the Torah, this becomes very clear from the beginning. Judaism did not have to exist. It wasn't supposed to exist. Adam's created in the Garden of Eden. Adam is given a mission. Adam is supposed to live up to his mandate. Adam fails, which right then stops us in our tracks. And what if Adam would have lived up to his mission? What if Adam and Eve would not have eaten from the tree? What if they would have simply hung out in the Garden of Eden with God for eternity? That is the concept of utopia. Okay, so let's leave it at that for a moment. Adam is a universal figure, represents the father of mankind, at least on a conceptual level. I don't care right now what problems you have in terms of a scientific or a practical level, but at least on a conceptual level, that's what Adam is. Adam is every man. Adam is mankind. So therefore, mankind is supposed to exist in the Garden of Eden, hanging out with God in a perfected world. It doesn't happen. Next opportunity, and there are many along the way. And I know that sometimes we don't like to play the game "what if," but what if Cain didn't kill Abel? What if? And you can go along the way. There's mysterious people along the way. A fellow named Chanoch, who God takes him, he disappears. And I won't talk about him. What about Noah, who's more famous? What if Noah, instead of going off onto the ark by himself with his family, what if he would have been able to energize, to excite, and to revolutionize the entire world? Is Noah a failed messianic figure? I mean, think about it. Theme of Noah is, the individual of Noah is somebody who I've spoken about in the past. There is a certain tragedy involved in Noah because he doesn't succeed. Perhaps he never saw that as his task. But what I'm pointing at is, long before Abraham, who was either the first Jew or the first proto-Jew, long before Moses, there were opportunities for the world to straighten itself out. It didn't happen. Abraham comes and he recognizes God. Abraham sets out to try to make a difference in the world. Abraham takes upon himself responsibility. He's not happy with the status quo. He wants to reach out. He wants to change society. His concept of monotheism is something which he understands to be an absolute truth, and therefore he cannot keep it to himself. It's not the sort of thing where you can really be politically correct and say, fine, if you want to be a pagan, and I'll be a monotheist. Abraham sees this as his absolute responsibility to spread this message about, and Abraham begins. What's interesting, though, is that I'll just give you one metaphor, perhaps. Remember when Abraham gets to the mountain together with his son, with Isaac, to offer Isaac up as an offering? He comes with two other people with him. And he says to them, you guys wait here. Me and the lad will go up to the mountain and serve God, pray to God, and then we'll come back to you. That, in a sense, is a metaphor for the Jewish experience. There are times that we separate ourselves from the rest of society, but we take upon responsibility to come back to the rest of society as well. And in order to, again, once you understand this, you have a much better idea about the Messianic age. Let me make another statement. Religious Jews understand something which I think most of the world doesn't understand. Do we want the Messiah to come? What's the answer? Yes. Look in your siddur at the end of the prayers. They have the animamim, the 13 principles of faith of Maimonides. One of them is, I believe with perfect belief in the coming of the Messiah, even though he shall tarry, I believe with every day that he shall come. Do we want the Messiah to come? Absolutely. When the Messiah comes, are we better off or worse off? That's a more complicated question. Let me put it in one level, and there are other ways of looking at it. On the one hand, you know, okay, one way of looking at it is certainly to say, well, a situation of no more war, no more bloodshed, and people living together in peace and harmony sounds like a better situation. I think we can all agree about that. On the other hand, if we'll look at it from a narrow, selfish perspective, is it more significant to perform a mitzvah, to listen to the word of God, to perform a commandment in today's world or after the Messianic age comes? Come on, let's admit something. If the Messiah were to, right, if the Messiah were to come tomorrow, right, and the Messiah shows God and God's will and might becomes manifest on this earth, possibly. There are two. Look, just give me one more sentence. Don't you think if that were the situation, it would be a little easier to keep Shabbos this week? There's no more question, no more doubt. Again, God is completely manifest. So realize something. Religious Jews walk around with this little secret. We know that all of our deeds will be less significant if the Messiah comes. If we wanted to be selfish, if we were only concerned with our own spiritual state of being, we shouldn't want the Messiah to come. Because now we possess the truth. There's a world which is difficult to perform the truth, to follow the word of God. So therefore, we should keep our little secret to ourselves, listen to the word of God, maximize our reward, and live this isolationist existence. The problem is that we understand, like I said from the beginning, we were not supposed to exist. The world was supposed, the mission is for the world to be completed. Not just one little group of people, the whole world. We took upon ourselves this mission. We know that when we succeed, the world will be a better place, and that is enough reward. The fact that specifically we will no longer get the same sort of reward for doing the commandments, that is not really the concern. But by the way, if I can point something out to you, the sort of absurdity which exists within the whole process of tshuva. Right now we're in Elul, we're getting close to Rosh Hashanah. Realize something. When a person wants to do something which is wrong, and they have incredible desire to do something which is wrong, if they control themselves and don't do it, do they get reward? Absolutely. What if they work on themselves to the extent they no longer want to do it? Do they get the same reward when they stay away from the thing which they no longer want to do? No. What's a better situation spiritually? To be getting more reward, or to have beaten that and no longer have the desire. Yeah, obviously the second one is better. But you're correct, you get more reward. You get more reward the other way. Which do we prefer? The struggle and more reward, or do we prefer the situation where things, where we spiritually, we're living in a more harmonious situation, rather than be pulled in different directions? And don't worry, in case you're suspecting that if you really do tshuva, if you really get close to God, you lose your freedom of choice. It's not the case. You always have freedom of choice. You're always being pulled. But just you're being pulled by things which are a little bit more elevated than you were pulled in other situations. Believe me, great rabbis also a mediocre rabbi, somebody who's a good person, could have a struggle between studying a text which is very, very challenging and will move him spiritually, or something which he just finds interesting. Now, neither of these are evil actions. But one will be more spiritually fulfilling, and that is the thing which brings a person closer to God. So let us continue. We now really do appreciate that as far as Judaism was concerned, Judaism didn't need to exist. So therefore, if we can create a situation that we're no longer necessary, that's a very good thing. I know a lot of corporations, I know this is a very bad business strategy. What you want to do is you want to create a market. Once you create a market, you want to get more and more people who want to support you, you can bring more and more income in, and you want to create a situation you'll be needed forever. But we realize that theologically we're not needed, we realize that God is the important thing, that this world is a theocentric world, a world where God stands in the center, and not an egocentric world where man stands in the center. Okay, so, and by the way, the sooner we realize issues like this, the sooner we can go through an individual type of a revolution and a breakthrough to realize that God really is the center of the world. And even something like Judaism is not the center. Now, and as I said, there could be many people who will be upset when they hear these sort of words, because I'm aware that the Torah tells us that God looked in the Torah, then created the world. And I'm not doubting that. I'm not questioning that. What I'm saying is that there is a truth in this world that needed not to take place in this particular way that it is taking place. So let's continue now. What is the idea of the Messiah? What is the concept? You know, if you go back a second to the world that Abraham came into, it was a cruel world. It was an ugly world. It was a world of paganism. It was a world where human life did not have value. It was a world where if somebody would have gone over to their... If Abraham would have walked up the block to his local pagan and said to one of his neighbors, "Sir, what do you think about a nation, about a unity of man? What do you think about peace on earth? What do you think about love as an ideal?" What do you think would have been the response? Punched him. He would have stabbed him in the eye. They wouldn't have understood these concepts. The pagan world was a world where power made right, might made right. The more people you can control, the more significant you are. And an idea of altruism, an idea of love, an idea of giving was something which was completely foreign. I want you to appreciate something. We've gone now 4,000 years since Abraham. The world has undergone a revolution. People sometimes call it the Judeo-Christian ethic. What is the Judeo-Christian ethic? No, it's Judaism, okay? It's Judaism as it was borrowed by Christianity. And, you know, fine, they want to call it Judeo-Christian, wonderful. Christianity actually, and I don't want to spend that much time with Christianity today, but Christianity adopted certain Jewish ideas. It also adopted certain pagan ideas. Judaism is, in a sense, if I can quote myself, Judaism is the illegitimate child that resulted of the affair that Judaism had with paganism. Christianity took certain Jewish concepts. Most of the time, it set it up as ideals and never became the reality. Think a second. Absolutely. Sorry. If I said that wrong, then I apologize. I'll say it again. Christianity is the illegitimate child of the affair which Judaism had with paganism. I said it wrong, then I take it back. I mean, even if you think for a moment, the whole time that Christianity was trying to sell itself to Jews, the main concept that it spoke of was Jesus as the Messiah. But what happened? The Jews didn't go for it. This is one of the interesting things about Christianity. The vast majority of people who ever came in contact with Jesus rejected him. The vast majority of people who believe in Jesus are people whose ancestors never met him. The one whose ancestors met him, they absolutely rejected him. You understand that? The people that accepted him are the people that never saw him, and those were the pagans. So therefore, Christianity picks up in Rome and spreads throughout Europe. In Israel, people didn't take it seriously. I mean, again, that is the, if you think about it, that is a very significant point. But what happens when, and you can go through the New Testament on this, what happens in the New Testament when Jesus is trying to be sold to the Jews, and there's certain Gospels that are speaking to Jews and certain Gospels that are speaking to non-Jews. When Christianity is trying to be sold to Jews, what it is Jesus is the Messiah. Everyone says, "What are you talking about? What do you mean Jesus is the Messiah?" And I'll come back and I'll explain this more in a moment. When Christianity gave up on trying to convince the Jews, it went to the pagan world, and the pagan world said, not is he the Messiah, they wanted to know, is he a hero? What is a hero in the Greek world? What's a hero? A child of a god and a human. Okay. So what happened is that once they try to sell it to the pagans, they say, yeah, but is he a hero? At that point is the first time you ever find the virgin birth and concepts like that, and then Jesus becomes a god and or a hero in the Greek model and not just in the Jewish model. And you realize something else. Judaism, which is a religion that believes in monotheism, believes in one God, was never going to be able to tolerate the concept of more than one God. But once you try to sell yourself to the pagan world, then you make adjustments as far as public relations and sales and so on dictate. And that's exactly what happened. But let's go back a bit and understand more importantly what happened. And the reason why we have to do this with a little bit of detail is because, unfortunately, most Jews know nothing about the Messiah. And most of us, if we learn anything about it, we learn it from the popular media, or worse, we learn about it from Christianity. What Christianity did is it separated two things which are impossible to separate. It separated the messianic age from the Messiah. In Judaism, what is the Messiah? The person who spearheads the Messianic age. How do you know that that person is the Messiah? Because the Messianic age is here. Get it? Was that complicated?
What's the Messianic age?
So therefore, we have to now go and explain, so what is the Messianic age? So if you want to start off, the Messianic age is a time where there will be no more war and no more bloodshed, and nations living together with one another in peace and harmony. When all that happens, you'll know that the Messianic age is upon us. No. What I said is that the Messiah is the individual who spearheads the Messianic age. What I said is that you cannot separate the Messiah from the Messianic age. That's an absurdity. What Christianity did is it said Jesus is the Messiah. Okay, where's the Messianic age? Second coming. And our response is, as soon as he comes back, then we'll reconsider. Till then, we're in the clear. Although, reportedly, Franz Rosenzweig was one of the great Jewish philosophers in the first part of the 20th century. He said, but if he comes back, we'll kill him again, as deserves any false prophet. So again, that's even a bit more harsh. But as far as we're concerned, you cannot separate the Messiah from the Messianic age. That's all. Christianity tried to do this. If you ever read through the debates, many debates took place during the Middle Ages in Judaism and Christianity. Whenever they would talk about the verses, the Christians, and again, you all appreciate that I'm saying this from a biased, self-serving perspective. So I challenge you instead, if you want, I challenge you to sit and to go through this yourselves, to read through the Jewish side of the debates and read through the Christian side of the debates, and see in what instances Christianity would take the verses out of context and or mistranslate the words. Again, I admit it, I'm biased. But you start reading, matter of fact, I'll go one step further. I think that if a person reads through the various debates and reads through the claims from both sides, I think that will convince somebody about the lack of truth of Christianity. I'm sorry if I'm speaking in such strong terms. I think that it's far easier to disprove Christianity than it is to prove Judaism's truth. Why is that? Because, look, to prove that Judaism is true, I would have to try to prove that God exists and God gave the Torah, and the oral Torah and the written Torah, all these things are authentic. Christianity gives me all that. It says, God exists, God gave us the Torah, the oral Torah is true. Oh, by the way, you heard that? According to Christianity, the oral Torah is true, the written Torah is true, everything is true. The oral Torah is true also. It's interesting, because they don't spend a lot of time talking about this. I had somewhat of a debate with a minister around a year ago, and the first thing he asked me, he goes, you know, you rabbis aren't fair, because every time we want to quote something from Scripture, you say, well, the rabbis explained it that way, and this oral Torah stuff, you know, like, it's not fair, you keep quoting that. So I said, what about the book? I said, first of all, the written Torah tells you have to listen to the oral Torah. I spent a little time showing him where it says that. That's not for today. I said, but the book of Matthew says it as well. Jesus says, the rabbis sit in Moses' seat. You should listen to what the rabbis say. He goes on to say that the rabbis are hypocrites, so don't follow their deeds, but follow what they say, because they have the tradition of Moses. I showed this to him inside, and he admitted it. He goes, you're right. How do they justify anything? That's a separate... You can't ask them these things. Which means, if they're accepting the validity of the oral Torah, why aren't they wearing their tzitzis out and keeping Shabbos? And, you know, there's all sorts of other things. He also says, I come not to destroy, I come to fulfill. Only problem is nothing was fulfilled. Sir?
Yes?
Yes. Hey, careful. Religious fanatics are very close to that. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Okay.
Whatever it is, I'm not sure of religion.
Right.
Everyone in that realm really is mocking a lot of things. But the ones that have, they are nice people. They
Right.
They
And that's very dangerous. Yes, yes. Sorry. That has been part of their plan, their doctrine, for the last 2,000 years. It's not something new. They just take different ways of doing it. Sometimes they tried crusades. Sometimes they tried, you know, pogroms. Sometimes they tried different things. But they've been trying to get us to follow for a while. You know what? I'll tell you something even deeper. We're getting now to the year 2000. Christianity, as I said, has a difficulty because of this problem, which I've already spelled out, separating the Messiah from the Messianic Age. According to their tradition, the Messiah is supposed to come by the year 2000. Okay, he's supposed to come back. Jerry Falwell recently said that he believes that the Antichrist is among us. Have you heard that? And he's most likely a Jew. Right? Needs to be stopped. Because everything's getting ready, according to their tradition, the Messiah is supposed to come back. It's very interesting because in Christianity, again, part of what I'm going to say now is difficult because the Gospels contradict one another. They just contradict themselves. But according to some of the Gospels, most of them, Jews did not kill Jesus. You understand that. The Romans did. So why are we always blamed? Isn't this great? The Vatican sits in Rome. They never hear them chasing Romans down the street and saying, you killed our God. When right? When the text says that they did, and they come around chasing us and saying, you know, you killed our God, which is itself an absurdity. How exactly do you commit deicide? And you kill a God? But okay. Think of it. By the way, you can go one step further. According to Christianity, Jesus died for everybody's sins. So if he died for the sins, it's a good thing that he died. They should be thanking us for killing him. Right? Of course, we killed him now they're cleansed. You never have that happening, right? You never have them chasing you down the block. Said, Jew, I love you. Because of you, I've been cleansed. What's the matter? No, you start thinking about the whole thing, and it's an absurdity. So when they speak about the crucifixion, what do they really mean? In Christian theology, the crucifixion doesn't mean to kill Jesus. The crucifixion means the rejection of Jesus. The Romans accepted him, so they're no longer guilty of killing him. The Jews didn't accept him, so they're guilty of killing him. Which means in 1962, the Vatican finally forgave us for killing him. It was after the Holocaust, and they sort of know it was worse than that. They realized that 2,000 years of Christian anti-Semitism resulted in a Holocaust, and they didn't want to take credit for that. So they tried to distance themselves from the events of the Holocaust. So they said, no, we forgive the Jews, so therefore we are not guilty for any anti-Semitism. Although I read a great article yesterday that stated that there was no anti-Semitism more than 100 years ago. You know why? 113 years ago. Because the term was first coined then. So before then it wasn't anti-Semitism. Just killing Jews, okay? It was wasn't as sophisticated. Anyway, they forgave us for killing Jesus. So now we get to the year 2000, Jesus is supposed to come back. What happens if he doesn't come back? Whose fault is it if he doesn't come back? It's the Jews' fault. So there we go, we're guilty of crucifying him again. Isn't that convenient? I mean, it's a wonderful philosophy, and it's great because we're always guilty. By the way, there's another issue that you have to be aware of, and this is extremely important. If you look through the various debates that I spoke about earlier, when you got to the section involving the verses, we always won the verses. As I said earlier, because they had to mistranslate, take things out of context. The virgin birth, the verses about the virgin birth, it's a joke. And it's a poor joke. It's a verse which is not talking about a virgin. It's not talking about a virgin birth. It's talking about a sign for a king who lived 500 years before the birth of Jesus. And the kid is born two chapters later. It said, you see the young woman who's pregnant? Here's a sign that this king was going to be forgiven, that there's hope. See this woman who's pregnant? She'll birth to a son. As there is a rebirth, you can be yourself change your ways. Two chapters later, the kid is born. And having nothing to do with any sort of birth of Jesus. They ripped the thing out of context. And by the way, once you see that, as I said, a Jew who doesn't know anything, who's caught on the street, he says, whoa, that's a good point, look at that. What they do is they'll open up to that one verse real quickly, mistranslate it, use their translations, it sounds great. So when it got to the verses, the Jews would always win the verse part. You know what the strongest argument of Christianity was during the Middle Ages? Well, if you guys are right, then why did God abandon you? Why are you traveling? why, it wasn't exactly like traveling, why are you wandering all over the earth? Obviously, God has rejected you. Who was the most strong, who was the strongest entity throughout the Middle Ages? The church. So obviously, God rejected Judaism and said to Christianity. That was their major argument. And if you really think about it, isn't that a pagan argument? Isn't that basically might makes right? Because we're stronger, therefore we're right. By the way, if you follow that argument, Abraham never should have began. More pagans around, so forget about it. Of course. Not only follows the rules. You're right. It follows the prophecy exactly. So realize. Let me go one step further. Realize the fact that we came back to Israel today is a major blow for Christianity, because they used to say the Jews have been rejected by God. They will wander this earth for eternity. They will never come back. They are eternal witnesses for the fact that they rejected Jesus. So I got really bad news for them. We're back. And by the way, you know what the Vatican's sophisticated response to this is? From 1948 till 1991, they refused to recognize the state of Israel. Said, we don't recognize you, so you're not really there. No, I'm not kidding. If I weren't kidding, okay, if I weren't serious, then it would sound like a really good joke. Between 1948 to 1967, they said, you're not really back because you don't have the old city. And after 1967, they said, we demand that there be a just and lasting peace with Jerusalem becoming an international city under the control of the Vatican, so therefore they can save face and say, see, they're not really back. We have control of Jerusalem. In 1991, when they began the peace process, Vatican then made a deal with Israel. We will recognize you on condition that when the final status discussion goes on Jerusalem, we're involved in discussions. What they're hoping is that Israel and the Palestinians are unable to make a deal over Jerusalem, and then the Vatican's going to move in and say, we have a solution. Jerusalem becomes an international city under control of the Pope, and therefore everybody lives in peace and harmony. And that was the change of policy because, again, I cannot overstress this. The fact that we are sitting where we are sitting right now disproves 2,000 years of Christian theology. The only problem is that most Christians don't know Christian theology. 2,000 years of disproof of the fact that we're sitting here right now. Let me throw out a little question for you. According to Christianity, what's the holiest place in the earth? Jerusalem or Rome? Jerusalem. Isn't it interesting that do you remember the last time a pope came to visit? I don't know. Absolutely. When was the last time a pope came to visit? Popes have refused to visit because they don't recognize it. If they come here, it means that Israel's here. As far as they're concerned, we're not here. Do you understand this? In 1967, around 2 months before the war, was the only time a pope ever stepped foot in Israel. Came from Jordan in the middle of the night for 2 hours. I know somebody who met him when he came. I have a friend whose father-in-law was the director general of the Ministry of Religion at the time, and they met him. Anybody know what the green line is? What's the green line? What is it? Why is it a green line? What? The green line is the line that divides between the pre-1967 borders and the post-1967 borders. So if you ask people why it's called the Green Line, I've heard wonderful things. One reason is because they made that line on the map with a green line. So it's called the Green Line. Do you know why it's called the Green Line? Because if you look from above, yeah, everything which was on the Israel side of the border was green. Everything on the other side of the border was complete desert. That's why it was called the Green Line. So this fellow who met the Pope, he said to him, you know, you claim that we're not really back. The land seems to disagree with you. The land seems to, and by the way, this is in the Bible, it's in the Talmud, this concept that when the Jews do come back, the lands will reach out to the Jews and welcome them back. And the land will remain without, again, the whole time that the Jews are not here, you know, you talk about the prophecies being few in number and going on into exile, but it also is when we come back, the land will embrace the people once again. So he said, it's really interesting, you don't think we're back, but the land sure does. But again, that this itself should help you understand this concept. As I said, Christianity is in an incredible, incredibly difficult situation right now. On the one hand, they've claimed for 2,000 years, Jews are not coming back. On the other hand, they claim for 2,000 years, Jesus is coming back. Right? So they have a little bit of a problem if the Jews, if the wrong Jews came back. That's the problem. Is that we came back to the land we weren't supposed to, and he was supposed to come back and he isn't. So they have a problem here. So what the Pope is now, when they changed the strategy in 91, is that the hope was, is that they tried to take a lot more effort in terms in converting as many Jews as possible. Try to get as many Jews to believe, because when the Jews accept him, so maybe that's the last thing that has to be done. Okay. By the way, there's certain groups of Christians which are different. Certain groups, especially in America, you have a lot of Baptists and others who completely ignored Christian theology, and their point was, no, let all the Jews come back to Israel, and then the Messiah will come. Then, which is true, except not who they think it is. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that could be a problem. They still call him Jesus. But see, your point is very interesting, and it's actually very disturbing for maybe for some people. What you're pointing out is that Christians believe in God, believe in the Torah, would believe in the Oral Torah if you pointed out to them they're supposed to, believe in the Messiah coming, believe in all these things. Are they closer to true Judaism than a Jew who doesn't believe in God or doesn't believe in the Torah, doesn't believe in the Messianic age? No, that's... One second. I know you didn't put it... You didn't set it up... Yeah, that's right. You didn't set it up like that. But I'm saying that's a very interesting thought. I know that Mati Berger has put that as a question in class a number of times, saying, well, you know, it seems if you take basic Jewish, take the Maimonides 13 principles, it seems that that Christians have much more of them than Reformed Jews do. No. Yeah, what do you... Not exactly. I do want to point something out that Maimonides said. And if you look for this, you may not find it, because it was censored out of Maimonides' writings. In the Book of Kings, where he speaks about the Messianic age, he says that God works in mysterious ways. I want you to think a second, and I'll quote him in a moment. We were supposed to create a society which was an advanced society. We were supposed to create a society that was a utopia. We haven't succeeded yet. We had an opportunity in the first temple. It didn't work. We go off into exile. Which means we were supposed to create a society that people from all over the world will look at this place and say, whoa, these people are living, they're happy, peace and harmony. What a wonderful place, what a wonderful religion, what a wonderful God. When we didn't impact people from living the way we were supposed to, we get sent off into exile. And one of the strange things of exile is, instead of being assimilated, instead of disappearing, we impacted upon the societies that we went to. We have a second opportunity, we came back, again, to build a utopia. It didn't work. We go off into exile again. God seems to say, now this is Maimonides' words, God seems to say, my will be done. Either you do it, or I will do it. You're supposed to spread the word of one God all over the world? Okay. As I said, 4,000 years ago, if Abraham would say, listen, you know, the Messiah is going to come, the average guy would say, Messiah, what do I need it for? What do I want it for? Why do I want world peace? This wasn't within the worldview of the pagan. Today you find a fascinating situation. How many people in the world today think that world peace is a good thing? I would say the vast majority. You know, right? The vast majority will tell you that's a good thing. The vast majority of the world today pays lip service. Not everybody lives that way. The vast majority of the world pays lip service to what they call now the Judeo-Christian ethic. Which means we succeeded in taking, and again, it's very funny how we did it. Maimonides says that the Jews didn't do it the way they were supposed to. Not that God rejected the Jews. God said, I'll give you a little bit of a help. I will water down Judaism in a way that it will be spread much quicker. I will create Islam. I will create Christianity. And they will now take Judaism in a watered-down version and spread the main teaching of monotheism throughout the world, spread the idea of the world being perfected throughout the world, so that when the Messiah really comes, it will be that much easier. Because today, what? Okay, that's Maimonides' point. So therefore today, instead of a situation of us facing hundreds of millions of pagans, what we have is hundreds of millions of people who believe in one God. Again, as I said, there's always been a difference between the things which Christianity especially has believed in versus the lifestyle which they've had. Throughout the Middle Ages, they've taught the meek shall inherit the earth. The meek did not inherit the earth in the Middle Ages. You had a caste system, you had your monarchs, you had the church, you had the meek working the earth. You had these people with miserable lives being told, oh, the meek will one day inherit the earth. Which means there was an incredible distinction between what they believed or what they said versus the way that they lived. In Judaism, by the way, the distinction was nowhere nearly as great. In Judaism, there was no such thing in the Middle Ages. Coming up to modern times, there was no such thing as the homeless. It didn't happen. Anybody come from an Orthodox synagogue? Remember, especially in America, after davening on Shabbos, they make kiddush and shul. Do you know where the custom comes from? Because in Europe, the homeless lived in the shul. The people that lived there. So shul was always a kiddush. People lived in shul. That was so much of a custom that it became institutionalized. And see, that itself is a major issue. So now let's look what has happened. The modern state of Israel, which also, there's no question God is involved in this. There's an opportunity. One of the great Zionist leaders, ever hear of him? Ben-Gurion sometimes gets the blame for this statement, but it was really a fellow named Gordon, who said that we want to create a state like every other state. How will we know when we made it? When you have Jewish women who are prostitutes, who are serving Jewish men, who are being arrested by Jewish police, being put in a Jewish prison. Then we become a normal society. And you know what? See, that's the antithesis of what we're trying to create. We don't want something which is normal. We want to try to create a society which is an elevated society. That is what our mission is right now. If God brought us back into this world, we're here to create the Messianic Age. We're here. But that's not something new. We've always been Messianic. But this idea of separating the Messiah from the Messianic Age, that's where the mistake comes in. Imagine if in Israel there were no prostitutes, there were no police, there were no police because there was no robbery, there was no crime, there were no drugs, there was no violence. All that you had people living together in peace and harmony. What would happen if we built a society like that? Not a normal society, but we built a really incredible society. What then would happen? Would that just make like the front page of Newsweek one week? Utopia in the Middle East, and that's it? Or would it have more of an impact on the world? Which means we can make an impact in more than one way. We can make an impact by being taken and going off into exile, and we tried that. The unbelievable thing about the exile is we stayed the same. We came back the same. It could be that at the end we came limping back. There's more than one way, by the way, for the Messianic Age to come. One way is that time sort of runs out. History, right? History runs out. At that point, God says, okay, you've gotten the end of time. Time for the Messiah to come. Time for the Messianic Age. The other way, which has been possible for at least the last 2,000 years, and really, in reality, from the very beginning of time, is for us to reach a level as a community that forces the Messiah to come because we've created that utopia. I can assure you that these two ways are not the same. To do it because time simply ran out is a process which is very, very painful. It's a process which hurts. To do it in the second way is an incredibly pleasurable experience, and that is completely up to us what the end game is going to be. It's sort of like a game of chess, and God says there's two different end games. It's up to you how you do it. You know, you can do it with having lost almost all your pieces, or you can get to like a three-move mate also. That's completely up to us. What we do have to understand is that this concept of the Messiah is the individual, and I'm just going back to what I said in the beginning, he's the individual who spearheads this movement, who leads the people back. Truth is, I'm being simplistic. The Talmud speaks of two different Messiahs, the Messiah the son of David, the Messiah the son of Joseph. The process is a much more complicated process than I'm spelling out over here, but I'm spelling out, I would say, the most basic parts of it. We have had a mandate since the creation of Adam. That mandate was to elevate the whole world, not just ourselves. Judaism has constantly had a concern. And again, there's a tension here. If you spend all your time working with people who are other than Jews, it could be that therefore you won't accomplish as a nation what you're supposed to accomplish. There's always been this tension. To what extent do we reach out to others? To what extent do we do it by ourselves? And I would say that the mainstream Jewish approach has been, let us create a society that others can see and use as a model, as an example. And I think that that way you really accomplish both. But then again, simply to stand on the street corner and to say, listen, you know, do this or do that, that's not real. People, and you know, especially children who are very sophisticated. Children listen to what their parents say, they follow what their parents do. Which means the best way to change our children, to change our friends, the best way to impact upon others in this world is by doing it by example. That has been the mandate of Judaism, to try to create this just society, to try to create this elevated society. And if we can accomplish doing that, it will absolutely elevate the world, and the whole world will follow suit. Because basically people have within them a spiritual component, and you have to show them what is true, and people, like a magnet, will be attracted to it. The problem is that people are also, they lack a consistency, an internal consistency, and therefore sometimes people are very happy to give lip service to the concepts, and therefore not necessarily follow in terms of practice.